From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
We bring you this podcast from Adelaide, where the ALP National Conference has been meeting for the last 3 days. It's been an exercise in projecting a united party ready for government, a conference managed within an inch of its life. The Morrison government had hoped to overshadow Labor with its positive budget update on Monday. But instead, the overshadowing came with a story that was very negative for the government, with the personal scandal involving the Nationals MP Andrew Broad. To sum up the ALP conference, we're joined today by Labor's deputy leader, Tanya Plibersek. Tanya Plibersek, what messages should voters be taking out of this conference?
Well, I hope they'll see that we are responsible, progressive, and ready to govern. Look, I think it's been a very constructive conference. We've made a number of very important amendments to our national platform that reflect good Labor values. We'll see substantial changes in industrial relations, for example, that will deal with one of the most pressing problems Australia faces at the moment, and that's historic low wages growth affecting consumer confidence, reducing aggregate demand in our economy.
Now, wages growth is obviously absolutely central to Labor's program and to many voters. Can you just be a bit more precise on how Labor government would deal with that?
Well, we've already made some very important announcements, like restoring penalty rates that have been cut under this government. But today, for example, Brendan O'Connor and I made an announcement about the gendered undervaluation of female-dominated industries, fixing up the fact that women who work in childcare, in aged care, in disability services, in healthcare, in other industries that are largely female-dominated, find it so very difficult to have the undervaluation of their work recognised in the current systems. We've said that we'll make changes to the way the Fair Work Commission operates, we'll make some changes to industrial laws and make sure that the Fair Work Commission has the ability to make proper orders dealing with the gendered undervaluation of work.
How would this work in practice? How much compulsion perhaps would there be on employers, and are there any targets over time?
Well, what we've said is there'll be a panel of the Fair Work Commission that will have responsibility for making equal remuneration decisions. That panel will have appropriate expertise on it. There'll be a research capacity at the Fair Work Commission to do the technical work that underpins these type of orders. And we think resourcing the Commission and changing the relevant laws is very important to deliver real wage justice for working women. But there are, of course, other things that we've announced, such as companies with more than 1,000 employees will have to make clear the gender pay gap that their own company has. We've said that we will institute targets for the reduction of the gender pay gap, and we'll report on whether we're meeting those targets to the Parliament. There are a suite of reforms that we've made that we think will help tackle the persistent problem of the gender pay gap that's bounced around at between 14 and 19% ever since we started measuring it.
Now, one of the areas that this is particularly important in is childcare workers. If you were talking to a childcare worker now, how much better off would you expect them to be in, say, 5 years of a Labor government?
Well, it's hard to just pluck a figure from the air. There's a lot of technical work that you have
to do. In comparative terms, yeah. I mean.
Well, I'll give you a historical example is probably the best way to do it. Since we've been able to take these work undervalued cases to the Fair Work Commission or its predecessors, we've seen more than 20 cases. Only one of them has been successful, and that's the Social and Community Sector Award. And we saw then increases of between 18 and 43% for workers in the social and community sector. So thousands of dollars better off. And those increases were spread out over 9 increases over the course of 8 years. So it is a a relatively gradual improvement, but a very substantial improvement, particularly at the upper end. I think it's impossible to just pick a figure when it comes to early childhood educators, but their work is substantially undervalued. You cannot think that it's okay for someone who's on a certificate four as an early childhood educator to be earning about half of someone who's got a certificate for TAFE qualification is working in a metal trades job. And that's really what we're facing. We're facing early childhood educators who can't afford to move out of home, who can't afford to send their own children to early childhood education. There is no question in my mind that the reason this work is undervalued is because it's largely female dominated. But the Fair Work Commission reinterpreted the legislation recently to say that there needed to be a male comparator to test this proposition against, and that's largely the reason that the union's claim in this case has failed. We're removing that necessity to have a male comparator, and we believe that that will make a big difference to the success of cases like this.
We heard today at the conference a strong speech from Sally McManus, the ACTU secretary. If there's a Labor government, would you anticipate that the union movement would have the sort of effective seat at the cabinet table that it had in the 1980s, albeit, of course, without the formal accord of those days?
I think a Labor government, if we are elected, will seek to work cooperatively with the trade union movement because we share the same objective, and we share an objective of having good quality, decently paid jobs that have some security and predictability to them. Now, the economy is changing so quickly, of course, the way people work will change to a degree as the economy changes. But what we've seen in recent years is a level of insecurity enter workplaces that is very unhealthy for family life and community life. And we continue to see company profits growing strongly, executive salaries growing strongly, but wages for ordinary wage and salary earners flatlining. We share an objective to fix those issues.
So would they have an effective place at the table?
Well, we'll have a cooperative relationship, and I think the way this conference has worked gives you an indication of what that'll look like. The union movement hasn't got everything they wanted from the Labor Party on this instance, but a lot of the changes that we have been made better by the discussions that we've had over many months leading up to this conference.
One union, the CFMEU, will have an expanded representation on the ALP National Executive. What are we to make of that?
Well, the National Executive's selected democratically. We have elections, we have ballots when they're necessary, and we'll see the outcome of that. I don't think it shuts till 2 o'clock, so we'll see what happens.
Let's turn to border security, which has obviously been a big debate in the run-up to this conference. The party's reaffirmed its support for boat turnbacks, but it's also, the Labor government would have an expanded refugee intake and a more compassionate approach to medical transfers. Now, you in the past opposed turnbacks. What's your message to those people who say that Labor does not have a compassionate enough policy, that turnbacks is the wrong way to go?
Well, there's nothing compassionate about suggesting to people that the best chance they've got to have a life in Australia is to pay a people smuggler and risk their life at sea. That is not compassionate. And We do need to make sure that we don't restart people smuggling. This is run by large criminal syndicates who make massive profits from preying on human misery, and I don't want that to underpin our Australian immigration system. But Australia needs to take more of its share of the 68 million people who are displaced around the world. We need to do better for people who are in countries in our regions who won't come to Australia. We need a stronger aid program to support them in countries of first asylum. And we need a more progressive foreign affairs policy too, where we say in situations like our relationship with Myanmar, stop persecuting Rohingya people so that they flee to countries like Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world. So we need a better refugee and asylum program, and that includes bringing more people, but bringing them safely on a Qantas jet with proper resettlement services when they arrive. It means a more activist aid policy and more activist foreign policy.
What was the deciding factor that did bring you round on the question of turnbacks over the last few years?
Well, we've had a lot of discussions in our shadow cabinet about the issue of people losing their lives at sea. I mean, the problem with the debate on asylum seekers is that the Liberals have a three-word slogan, but sadly on the other side, people who see themselves as progressive or compassionate, sometimes they kind of degenerate into three-word slogans too. And we can't afford to do that. If we are a genuinely compassionate country, we can't say to people, the best chance you have of living permanently in Australia is to get on a boat, to pay a people smuggler and get on a boat. There are, you know, women with children living in refugee camps in South Sudan, in Jordan and Lebanon, fleeing Syria, in southern Turkey, around the world. Look at what's happening in Yemen at the moment. If we really want to help the most desperate people on the planet, then we need to find them, process them, bring them safely to Australia and support them when they get here.
The issue of New Start's been somewhat of an irritant in the debates around the edges of this conference. Labor's committed to a review of New Start rather than an immediate increase, which some of your supporters believe it should have said it will undertake. Is this really just a process question? Do you think that a Labor government would increase New Start after that review?
Well, I think it's impossible to review New Start and come to the finding that it doesn't need to be increased. We know that even the Business Council of Australia and other organisations that are generally more conservative agree that New Start is inadequate. It's a matter of by how much it's inadequate. And there's a science to this. We don't just make up numbers. We need to properly review the adequacy. I'm certain, in fact, that a recommendation of the Productivity Commission will be for an increase, but we want to see by how much and over what period.
So the review is about quantum rather than whether it goes up or not.
People are trapped into unemployment because New Start is too low for them to dress themselves appropriately and catch the train to a job interview. That's a problem.
In your own electorate, you're very familiar with the threat of the Greens. The Greens are a big force in the seat of Sydney. I wonder how you see the Greens nationally in this coming election. Are they going to be able to take a lot of votes from a pragmatic Labor Party, or do you think the Greens have in fact peaked and, because of their own divisions, will not be such a force as in previous elections?
I think the Greens' internal divisions are poisonous and potentially fatal for the Greens as a political party. And I'm obviously closest to the New South Wales conflicts, and they're the ones I have the most insight into, but I'm not sure how the Greens in New South Wales stay as one party when the divisions are as deep as they are.
Do you think they'll split?
I think they might, yeah. I think they might. But certainly the parliamentary Greens, I don't know in the New South Wales Parliament how they can continue as one party with the divisions as deep as they are. And the I'm not sure about the policy divisions. I don't have a lot of insight into what the actual policy differences are. But plainly the personality differences are at a level kind of beyond nuclear at the moment.
Obviously, the Labor Party is looking to this election that's coming next year very confidently. It is trying to make sure it's not seen as measuring up the curtains, but nevertheless, it feels that is on the way to victory. But things can always go wrong. And so I wonder how you see the dangers that you have to avoid in those early months of next year.
Look, I was around. I was campaigning in 2001, and Labor was ahead in the polls, as you would recall, for a substantial part of that time between the 98 and 2001 election under a very good leader, Kim Beazley, a fine man. As people often say, the best Prime Minister Australia never had. We lost the 2001 election. Things change very quickly in politics. We take nothing for granted. We take nothing for granted. We know that there'll be scare campaigns. The Liberals try a new scare campaign every week, and they have the support of, I've got to say, pretty compliant media in News Limited and its associates. They're very happy to run these scare campaigns against Labor. I hope they'll be unsuccessful. I think the efforts of running scare campaigns in the Victorian election didn't help the Liberals in Victoria, but we'll see.
Well, just on that, Kevin Rudd was very strong in addressing the conference about the Murdoch mafia and attacking News Corporation. Do you agree with those sentiments?
Look, I think there are some excellent journalists that work for News Limited, but I think there is a pretty clear editorial line from the organisation, and it's not an editorial line I expect will be favouring us at the time of the next election. Let's just put it that way.
But do you think that the public takes so much notice of the media these days? Because the media, after all, is very fragmented, and also many people are just disillusioned with politics and tune out.
I think the rise of organisations like yours really have been an antidote to some of the, I suppose, narrowness of the debate that we have sometimes seen in our media environment. And that's why I always tell people that it's important to support media diversity. I think the traditional sway that some media institutions used to have has been a little diluted, but it's partly because people have developed such a cynicism about politics and public life and democracy, and the media, I think, is wrapped up in that. It's not targeted at the media alone. And so we need to not just support a diverse media with lots of independent voices, we actually have to restore faith in our democracy if we want to address some of the underlying problems that we see.
And just finally, in the next few months, what are the most important preparations for government, for Labor, and indeed for you personally, as someone who, if there is a Labor win, be taking over a very, very senior job?
Well, I think the most important thing is continue to get our policies right, make sure that we are ready to govern if we are elected, that we have our costed policies ready for implementation. I think it's very important too that we continue to make sure that the healthy communication that we've adopted within the party, within the parliamentary party, the way that we've ironed out where we have differences of opinion, I think that's been really good for us. And we need to make sure that we maintain and protect that as we, if we go into government, as we take on those greater responsibilities.
Are you suggesting that maybe unity is harder to preserve in government than in this period when the prizes seem so close?
No, I'm suggesting that when you've got a bunch of passionate people who think they're absolutely right about the antidote to any problem, that getting them to work through and come up with a solution that is durable, that's never easy. Opposition government, I think we're doing it really well now in a really healthy way, and we've got to keep that up.
Tanya Plibersek, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our podcasts for this year. We'll be back with more interviews next year. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.